ABC Listen. Podcasts, radio, news, music, and more.
Hello, I'm Cassie McCullough, and this is The Bookshelf, which means if you're looking for a good book, you are in the right place. Each week, we review fresh new fiction from Australia and around the world. Usually, I'd be saying hello to Kate Evans, but today, Jonathan Green, presenter of Every Bite on ABC Radio National, is here. Jonathan, hello to you.
Cassie, hello. I'm looking for a good book. Can you help?
Yes, well, you are in the right place. Well, that's up for debate. Let's find out. We've got some interesting titles ahead. One of them is called Awake, Awake by Fiona Moseley. A young woman begins to suspect that her grandfather murdered Adolf Hitler.
Before. As you do.
That's right.
It's a small premise, but there it is.
Ever woken up in the middle of the night and thought,
did my grandfather kill Hitler?
Before slipping back into ordinary life. Well, look, it's a tale all about the lives we construct.
All about memory and reality.
That's right.
How very now.
Zan Rowe, presenter of Take Five on Double J and host of Race Around the World on ABC TV, will give us her thoughts on that. Also, Jonathan, the latest from the Dublin writer Neve Campbell, winner of the Rooney Prize for Irish Literature, a book of psychological intrigue. A young couple whose daughter, Sunny, starts asking some, well, strange questions.
Quite ghostly, in fact, but it's not a suspense thriller. It's something more than that, I think we'll discover.
Best-selling author Madeline Gray will give us her thoughts on that. But first, Jonathan, to a new Australian book, a fresh new voice, with a collection of stories about an Australia that's familiar but not quite as we know it.
This is Chris Ames, is the author, and this book... This won the Victorian Premier's Unpublished Manuscript Award, and it's a rather surprisingly varied collection. You know, it's a real showcase of Chris's craft, I reckon.
Mm. He's very funny. In fact, he's an American-Australian who was living in California before moving here after meeting his Australian wife. Let's just hear a little bit of his acceptance speech when he did win the Victorian Premier's Unpublished Manuscript Award.
My haters and rivals, many of which are here this evening, have tried to discredit this award, pointing to the slightly oxymoronic quality of best unpublished, saying that's like being what, like the most conventionally attractive person at a speed dating mixer. Or like being the most ornately decorated piece of fish still rotating alone on the sushi train. But I strongly disagree. I'll tell you the same thing I tell my wife when she questions my incessant high-risk sports betting. It actually takes a tremendous amount of courage to put money on an underdog.
So good. And what you hear there, that archness, that is just through this book and through his writing. He's sharp, he's funny, he plays with style. Yeah, he's quite a guy and clearly has potential for a career in stand-up.
Yeah, he sure does. Look, he had me at hello with this book, as they say. Just on the first page, I started laughing. In this first story, it's called It's Already Tomorrow in Australia, which wins as a title straight away.
Yes.
He works with a company called Inner Weather. It's Melbourne-based, of course, Jonathan, like you. Here, the co-founder is talking. This is the very first bit. This is the only career in the world where if someone falls asleep to your work, it means you're doing a great job, Anise says. She has a few of these. Put your heart into beginnings, she says. Ideally, they'll never know how it ends. She laughs the way all executives do, with the gilded confidence of someone who's never been told they aren't funny.
Why is this feeling like my workplace?
Well, speaking of your workplace, it wasn't long before I read the next thing, which was incredible. He's sitting down at his desk and he says, okay, I'll open up a document on my computer to title Every Living Person in Melbourne. I write my son's name, my partner's, and three of my co-workers. Yes. Sterling, Rita, Nick, Nick, Nick. Now, I found that particularly funny because I had just finished a conversation with three of my colleagues who were all called Nick, Nick Bryant being one of them. So, you know.
But it is such an interesting thing for a collection of short stories too that, you know, in the sort of Cheever Ford kind of canon of short story books, you expect a certain sort of consistency of tone and vibe. You don't get that here with Chris Ames. I mean, you kind of do in a way. It's all coming from the same sort of arch intelligence, but he is really playing. He's really trying stuff out across this range of stories. Let's skip to the story that's the titular piece.
Oh, yes.
It gives the book its title, I Made This Just For You. Now, in this one, a couple have a child, though they decide mid-pregnancy that, well, they are over as a romantic pair. Here's a quote, June and I are not technically together, so she's allowed to break my heart as long as it's funny. Which is such a beautiful thought. I love that. So our hero Jacob moves in with his brother, and he and June co-parent.
Sorry,
little
Benji.
Sorry,
you forgot this line. Jacob, you have no practical skills whatsoever, June says to me, and yet they still let you be a father. What a country.
So Jacob is they've split up, they're, you know, co-parenting, but Jacob is moving in with his brother, and there are all sorts of logistic challenges, two homes in different bits of San Francisco. And money becomes an issue, and the more so when it turns out that Benji needs eye surgery. June is doing okay. She is a comparatively functional human being. Jacob has to find work, and how to describe this? He gets a job which is as the voice via online chat for various porn performers.
Look, everyone's got to have a second gig.
You've
these
got to
days.
Have a gig. It's not so much your second gig.
Besides parenting.
Well, and eventually the online and the actual coincide here. It's sort of there's a seriousness here. This is a study of the awkward moral positions of modern online labour. It's a bit dystopian, but it's kind of made accessible through the familiarity with the patterns of parenthood. It's clever and funny and sad.
Yes.
Great little piece.
Yeah, and he has to ask his brother, who's doing sort of okay, Lucas, if he can live with him and also raise the child part-time there. So, you know, that's a tough thing, and Lucas goes along with it until they need to come up with this money for the operation.
Well, he asks the brother, can you give me a loan? Mm. He says, living rent-free is kind of a loan, don't you think?
Yeah, yeah.
Oh, ow.
And so then he replies, Benji may never see how ugly you are if you don't contribute.
I mean, we're having a lot of fun here, but it is amusing but beautifully serious and unexpected, and the turns it takes into the culture I think are really interesting. And this is the thing, Ames is a really precise and astute observer of the culture.
Yes.
In various sort of guises, you know, he's got a great eye for the world.
Someone described this as uncanny, which at times it really is, with strange artifacts and anxieties of our times, but also ultra contemporary. And I think that's really just hit the nail on the head because it feels like so now it's almost hasn't happened yet.
Which gives everything a kind of surrealistic edge.
Mm.
But it's a surrealism based on, yes, that sort of hyper-reality, which, yeah, puts you into an uncanniness.
Mm. Should we talk about the story that's called That Is Not a Cat?
I think we should. Did you like that one?
Yes. Look, you know, there is so much to like in this. I'm out in the garden. I'm not smoking again, but having a little cigarette here and there is a treat.
Yes. I think we've all been there.
There's this sort of edge in this one. I mean, did you like this one?
I did. And this, you know, we're talking a lot about AI at the moment. And here's a rather nice sort of AI-centered piece.
Mm. Let's talk about another story which is striking and one of the standouts, I think. I mean, all short story collections, with very few exceptions, have a variety of styles or qualities and also a variety of success. And this is one that I think is very strong.
Mm.
It's a woman. She's in an apartment. She's sitting in the shower and she says, I was sitting in the shower when I realised everyone needs a clean space in which they can give up. Cats and children know this inherently. So, you know, there's this sort of, what would you call that? I mean, it's a depressive start. But then from there, she thinks, oh, what if I got a new apartment, you know, with change of scenery, somewhere with some good light, which is the title. So that goes on for a little while. And then she starts cleaning. And I think cleaning is always, you know, I think psychoanalysts are always fascinated by people who resort to cleaning because it's just so, you know, clear what's going on there. Well, maybe it's not. I don't know. Anyway, so she starts cleaning this drain. She
pulled, what lies within.
Exactly. She pulls the grate off and she's got a rubber glove on and she slides. She can feel this blockage. And it's awful. Too warm and slick a sensation to be coming from something mechanical. I pinch my fingers together and grip something hard floating in an oily netting, a bulbous knot like a knuckle. And horrified, I keep pulling. I pull hard and dredge out a congealed braid of hair the length of an arm. So that she keeps pulling and it keeps coming. And then there are two arms of hair and they're attached to this thing like a head. And she keeps pulling and there's this hideous pop. And out comes this creature.
The creature.
With arms and a head just like mine, sitting in the shower beside me.
It's still, though, grounded in that sense of the real. You know, this is obviously lurching into a certain kind of magicalness here. Mm. But nonetheless, very gritty, very touchable.
Mm. It's sort of wonderful and shocking. And so there's this creature, this person, this hair being that's in her apartment. It actually reminded me, Jonathan, of a short film that actually goes way back. It was a New Zealand filmmaker, 1989, and it was called Kitchen Sink. And almost the same thing happens.
This woman, creature in the sink.
The creature in the sink. This woman starts pulling and the hair gets thicker into a kind of rope and eventually she pulls out this thing, like a body thing, and it falls onto the kitchen floor and she doesn't know what to, you know, she wraps it in plastic, she doesn't know. And eventually it's a man. It's a very hairy man.
Well, you sent me a clip to it.
Yeah.
She has to shave the creature, which it was a very unsettling part of this little film.
Yeah, and then they fall into a sort of romantic relationship. Now, this short film, like, it was so shocking and stunning. I mean, it won a lot of awards, went to Cannes, etc., this little New Zealand film, and it made Alison MacLean's career. But I can't imagine that Chris Ames has seen it.
Or whether it's the sort of extrapolation that all of us make from having once cleaned the shower and taken the grate out and pulled at that bit of hair. Which I think is that's the thing which you can exaggerate to tremendous effect.
Yeah, or if it's like a trope or something that's known that he's riffing on. I couldn't see any evidence of that when I went looking, but
the hair sink trope. Now performing at a pub near you. Look, a tremendous collection, though. And, you know, that's also the beautiful thing about a collection of short stories. Well, the beautiful thing, or perhaps the less beautiful thing, that they are pretty well realised. You know, a lot of short stories leave you with that famous technique of hanging there that you don't have to resolve.
Yes.
These are pretty well resolved pieces. They create little entireties.
I do hope that he writes on, and I hope eventually he writes a full length.
A novel would be great,
wouldn't
I think.
It?
And he absolutely has the capacity
for
that.
Got it in spades.
Yes.
Yeah. Look, just this little bit of observation back to Inner Weather, the Melbourne-based, you know, whatever it is. They're meeting with their people, their counterparts in the US. They're on a video call and they say that, and the Yanks say that the Australians all look like stagehands because they're wearing black all the time. And the Australians say back to them that the Americans look like they're hiking to a job interview because they're all wearing puffer vests over their work shirts.
Just a beautiful summary of cultural difference.
It's just that little observation I love, because you've kind of seen it, but you never thought to make fun of it.
And those were the words to describe that moment that I felt.
That's right. Yeah.
Chris, tremendous book.
Keep going. Come on.
I Made This Just For You is the book of which we speak. It's by Chris Ames and published by Ultimo Press.
This is The Bookshelf on ABC Radio National and ABC Listen. Let's say hello to today's reviewers. With us, Madeline Gray is a novelist, academic, writer of arts-related content and also a book critic. You may have read Green Dot or, more recently, Chosen Family. Always great to see you, Maddie.
Thank you so much. Always an absolute pleasure to see you, Cassie.
We're also joined by a study in fabulousness, Zan Rowe. She's presenter of Take Five, the podcast and the TV show. You'll find them. Double J and iView, and host of Race Around the World on ABC TV. How wonderful.
So wonderful. Hi, everyone. I'm so happy to be back.
You're not racing around the world. You're here.
Sadly, I just race to a studio while I watch everyone else go on an adventure, but it is a very fun adventure.
You got the short end of that stick.
I really did need to talk to the producers about that one for next year.
Yeah. The reception's been great. How's it been going from your side?
Oh, it's so fun. And it's happening in real time. So we're still filming the episodes while they're out there, and then because they're out for 10 days making a film and then it's going to air on 7 days, the show's kind of catching up with itself. So I've had a bit of a sneak peek into the future, but they're still out there on these wonderful adventures. And just seeing people find original stories and then be put in the pressure cooker to turn a film out of them within 10 days is amazing and incredible what they're achieving. They're all so different as well.
And what's amazing too, if we look back to the first iteration of this all those years ago, the people that made their bones in that are now part of our sort of normal public conversation, it's such a great place to be from.
It was the launching pad for so many, for John Safran obviously, but the guy that...
John Safran, who's that?
Some fella.
Some guy.
I have to
some
tell you bag. A story about that. In 1995, I was a staff writer for Good Weekend magazine, and I pitched a story of following this show the ABC was doing. So I bundled along and basically went through the initial training with all those guys.
But on
my first day, the producer, she said to me, "You've got to come and see this. There's one talent here that we think is going to go the whole way." And she showed me the initial audition tapes that John Safran had sent in.
Where he was drinking his own urine.
And he's now your judge.
Yeah, well, I mean, actually, they asked them to
beautiful
put down
transition.
10 seconds of black before they started their short, and John said that he couldn't find any black, but would they like 10 seconds of Black Sabbath? It went from there, you know. Yeah, so he was a legend before.
He's always been cheeky, hasn't he?
Yeah. But it's such a brilliant idea, sending people out with cameras into the universe is...
It's amazing.
Instantly compelling.
And it's, even though it's, you know, 28 years between seasons, it's just the perfect show for now. Perfect show for now. So, yeah, we're so excited that it's back.
Mm-hmm. Well, let's get to the books that you've both read for us today. Jonathan and Yuzanne have read Awake, Awake by Fiona Mosley. The British writer Fiona Mosley was born in 1988 and she grew up in York, but she now lives in Edinburgh. She graduated from King's College, Cambridge, and she started work on a PhD about the concept, I'm waving my little finger quotes around here, the concept of decay in the late Middle Ages. Now, obviously, that was interesting enough for her to spin off and write a novel kind of on the same subject matter called Elmet, which went on to win a whole range of awards, the Somerset Maugham Award, the Polari Prize, and it was shortlisted for the Booker as well. She followed it up in 2021 with Hot Stew, about a couple from the old Soho sex work scene who take on developers. And we've reviewed both of those here on The Bookshelf, and Kate Evans in particular is a big fan. So now, Jonathan, we have Awake, Awake. Where are we this time?
Well, we are in fact in York, in northernmost England. And this is a story that deals with the unreliability of memory and how that forms a precarious perception of reality. It's sort of like a postmodern Proust. Could I say that?
Sure. You got the mic. You can say whatever you want.
I should have said Madeline Gray.
Very nice. Nicely
would
done.
You like?
No, I'm gagged.
We can come to Madeline's anon. But memory, I mean, it's been a potent thing through literature. Anne, this is, I mentioned Proust, this is not an intimidating read. This is a lively and engaging novel.
Yeah, at the risk of sounding cliche, it is a page-turner, and I couldn't put it down.
That.
Yeah, and I think that it's because it deals with memory and touches into, for me, something that I found really relatable, these circle of friends that the protagonist, Mary, has grown up with, and then they do their own thing and they kind of sprawl out in various ways. But also there's this other storyline going through, which is either something that has happened in history, which is, I don't want to give any spoilers, but you cannot believe, or a form of psychosis on the part of Mary. So
there's some blurring there. I mean, she admits through this that this is her problem with being flooded by recollection. And being uncertain herself, the stuff which she recalls with such vividness, with such vivacity, is in fact real.
I think also just the perception of how people remember different, a shared memory too is explored in that way. The way that you experience something could be different to the way one of your friends did, an ex-lover did, all of that stuff is kind of subtly explored. But this particular parallel story of this wild moment in history that may or may not have happened.
We can say a bit about it, can't we?
Well, okay, I mean, how much do you want to give away?
Mention the H word.
Hitler.
Look, there are reviews around with the headline, "Did my grandfather kill Hitler?"
It's true, yeah. So, yes,
this is
not bearing the lead
this
here.
This is what Mary wonders, did my grandfather kill Hitler?
Yeah, and there's a story going around that possibly her grandfather could have been in the bunker and could have actually assassinated Hitler. So every time she comes up against that story with some strange men who could be spies, they could be Nazis, who are these people? She has these blackouts, which then further this uncertainty of what her actual memory is across the board. She's having conversations throughout as well with her psychologist or psychotherapist.
An analyst.
Sati, who's trying to draw this out of her. And there is a history of mental health in the family and poor mental health in the family. So there's a lot going on.
I think, but to get a bit meta about it, I think this book, it's a really interesting study on how the literary imagination can pick at some central cultural ideas without being really didactic and look. Because it deals with memory, it deals with the world you create. And that's sort of the moment we're living in. You know, people are creating a world and they hold to that world. The fact that she goes very big picture with, did my grandfather kill Hitler, is, I think that's kind of a piece with that study of how we're making this world now out of a whole lot of individual senses of reality.
So we're all a little bit fractured, just like the protagonist.
It's so true.
Yeah.
So true. How does she deal with that unreliable memory thing through the book? Is that a tricky thing to read?
It's slightly confusing at first. I read this mostly in one sort of sitting. I read a big sort of first third of it over a couple of days, and then I won't lie, my homework was due.
It was yesterday.
It was yesterday. I'm just going to be honest with you, it was yesterday. But I also think that the like I think most books, unless they're really quite dense, this is a really easy book to read. And I think that helped because there were these different lines, not even parallel, but almost like three lines going through the book that you had to follow. So reading it in such an intense period helped me.
Mm.
But yeah, I got a little bit confused here and there, more to the fact of what is the point of this other story? And to the very last page, as we were driving closer and closer to this confrontation she has with these mysterious men who are in fact telling her that, yes, her grandfather did kill Hitler, whether or not that happens,
the
another thing.
The book's downfall moment, if you like.
The book's downfall moment. I'm turning the page, it's going to be a big reveal. And then the final paragraph I found really flat. I was like, what's the point?
That is getting a bit spoilerish.
What's the point? But I loved the book.
But that's the thing, because I think the thing that actually sustained me through the book was the childhood friendships, that sort of through line of...
Same.
Of association.
Oh, yeah. Like what? Tell us more.
Well, there's one particular character in it. Oh, well, there's a little handful, this little bunch of mousketeers. But there's this one kid who's troubled and who never actually falls on the right side of, you know, of having a good time. He's an outcast. We begin with kids that are being fostered within a sort of a farm setting here in rural UK. he's one of them, and he falls foul of that through sort of, you know, bad behaviour, and continues that chain of bad behaviour through life to the very final pages of the book. And he's a tremendously compelling character because you kind of don't get him. Kind of don't get why his life is so troubled and so uneasy.
But he is always on the outskirts, much, I think, to the detriment of that final paragraph. Mm. Like, why have we come back to Billy Fletcher? And
with such engagement with those, with the final moments of the book, he is the centre of great drama.
Yeah. I also really love the friendships in this book, Jonathan. I just found that I related to a lot of them. I related particularly to the way that we grow from children to teenagers to young adults to adults, and how what a blessing it is when we can actually, you know, grow together. But more often than not, you grow apart, you make choices, or choices are made for you, and then you spiral off into every which direction. And if you're lucky, you come back like Amelia and Mary reunite in a beautiful way in this book after she's kind of made a choice that has sent her life down a total different trip.
Amelia's another one of those little mouseketeers.
Yeah. But it is, it's remarkable the way that it captures friendship, and not just relationships between the kids who become adults, but also the parents and the kids and the family relationships in this small
parents
community.
Are interesting. And we're in York, right? So York is a very churchy town. And Mary's dad is a reverend, and they live in fancy church accommodation at one point and then don't. And there's a falling out between the hierarchy and Mary's dad, which is interestingly sort of nebulous in the book too.
What's that about? What's the falling out about?
Well, unclear.
I think that there's a point where something terrible happens in the town. There's a fire and there is a response to that where the people who were burned in the fire were protesting. They were anti-establishment. They were quote-unquote political in their views, and therefore there shouldn't be a memorial run by the church at the time because it would be seen to be political.
Which Dad does.
Which Dad does. He sees these people who are saying no as careerists who are trying to protect their own interests instead of showing humanity and creating a space for people to grieve. So he does a kind of after hours cloak and dagger memorial service for the community, and then shortly after leaves the church because his faith has been tested and it hasn't stood up.
This gives you a sort of sense, I think, Cassie, of the complexities here. It's a very multi-layered book, and there's so much going on that I think it would need a lot of storyboarding on the on the part of the author to keep track.
We were sort of talking about how we imagined that Fiona Mosley had been, you know, done the classic author thing of all the post-it notes are up on the wall and she's finding the links and the flow through, and maybe a couple of them could have had a few more post-it notes.
Sadly,
in that section.
Sadly, two-thirds in the cleaner came in.
Well, I will just interject here and say I interviewed Fiona a few years back when she did Hot Stew, and she did confirm she does actually have a kind of
she's
serial killer
girl.
Wall.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Oh,
yeah.
Really? I can see that here. And you know what? Don't get me wrong. I really loved this book, but there was just parts where it was like, I wish there was a few more post-it notes on that part of the wall. They just felt like the climax of the book. I needed more to really understand why this was so important.
But is that a tricky thing for the reader, though? If for the author you need that kind of visual plotting of character and the, you know, progress through the book, the reader doesn't have that. The reader is sort of left to sort of work this out for themselves and to hold it in their own imagination and their own memory.
But the author's creating that world. The creating of the world is way harder than the reading of that creation.
I want this book to come with post-it notes.
Well, look, let's ask the actual author.
I was going to say, I'm sure Maddie's got some thoughts on this.
So, Madeline Gray, you have not only read all of the work of Fiona Mosley previously, you read her two earlier novels, and you interviewed her about Hot Stew, and I know you're probably very excited about reading this next one. How do you describe her work, and does this fit in with it?
It sounds like, I haven't read the new one, but it sounds like it's a bit of a departure in the sense that her two previous novels are very much concerned with landscape and the way that land flows through us and like the levels of story that are in place. And it sounds to me like with this new book, she's doing that, but she's looking more at how kind of memory is the through line through all of our minds that connects us. I mean, in Hot Stew, she's very much concerned with gentrification and evil landlords and the kind of bureaucratization of like housing estates in London, in Soho specifically. And then, you know, Elmet, it's a family drama, but it really is, you know, it's like, you know, in Sex and the City, where like the fifth character is New York. The other main character is the land. And so it sounds like she's kind of gone in a bit of a different direction.
Place is still strong in this. Okay. I was going to say that that's definitely something she draws on.
Okay.
And we get a real clear sense of, York and its environs.
Yeah, in a beautiful way.
Yeah. Mm. Well, yeah, very evocative.
Yeah, because that was one of my favourite things about her writing, the way she described land.
Because Elmet, as I said, is the Celtic kingdom that once was Yorkshire. And actually, we just read Land by Maggie O'Farrell recently here, and that too is about the earlier inhabitants still existing in some way in a landscape. I think, and I've seen this a lot in writing and reading over the years recently, and I wonder whether it's part of a broader movement, a kind of eco-anxiety about losing that older ancient connection with land that's surfacing in literature at
the
moment.
Absolutely, yeah, I think that makes sense. I mean, the kind of erosion of, to tie it all together, the erosion of memory that happens with the dislocation of land as the climate crisis continues. Mm. I see that.
Mm. And I wonder too whether writers are grappling with a sense that we're sort of betraying history, you know, that these people have been and they have made these things and we are in the process of destroying it all.
Well, Ian McEwan's book of last year, what we can know is about all of this. Mm. It's absolutely spot on about all of this, and it's chilling in its telling as well.
But on that happy note.
No, I think you're absolutely right. Ian McEwan's What We Can Know, another. I hadn't actually thought to put that in that collection of books. Well, I think we're on to something there.
Yeah, I mean, and then also The Ruiners, which I talked about last time, literally about the kind of disinheritance from environmental collapse.
Mm. And it's increasingly a theme in Australian literature, and that's kind of exciting, actually. I mean, not that we're just joining in with the rest of the world.
We're not celebrating climate disaster. Let's make that clear.
It is Mosley's gift, though, that I think she deals with these things at that lovely arm's length that literature gives, that it's a sort of a poetic imagining of those issues. It's not shoving it down your throat, but it makes you think about that as a consequence of reading what she thinks.
She's a page-turner as well. That's the thing. It's a really easy read about a lot of big concepts, which I think is the fact. I haven't, I'm not like you, Madeline, I haven't read any of her work before. Is she usually quite approachable? Because she's really packaged together some big concepts in what is a thrilling read.
Mm, I mean, I think I feel a kind of kinship with her because, you know, she was doing a PhD and it was all, you know, very esoteric. And then she started writing Elmet kind of as a way to think about what she was doing in her PhD, but in a way that was accessible and that the general public could actually read. And that's kind of what I try and do in my fiction as well. So
You are an academic and then just happened to knock off this book called Green Dot, which was a bestseller and has been optioned and being adapted for the screen. Like, I mean, it's fantastic.
I wasn't longlisted for the booker, but, you know, next time.
Both of you are big ideas for dummies is what you're saying. And I'm thankful for it.
No, we're big ideas and words that don't make you want to strangle yourself.
Yeah, well, that certainly happens a lot in fiction. So, okay, we kind of want to like this more than perhaps we enjoyed reading it, I'm hearing people.
I think we enjoyed reading it.
Yeah, I really loved it.
But that doesn't mean you come away from it thinking, what happened there?
It wasn't flawless, but I thought it was very good.
Still a gem.
Still a gem, and I highly recommend it. I've already thought about a number of people, and particularly people in my own friendship group that I, you know, press this into the hands of.
That is Awake, Awake by the British writer Fiona Mosley. You're listening to The Bookshelf on ABC Radio National. Now, To Make Strange by Neave Campbell. Now, that's Neave, N-I-A-M-H, not to be confused, Jonathan Green, with the other Neave Campbell.
Oh, you mean Neave Campbell, the Canadian actress?
That's right. Yeah. Who you might remember from the 90s, Jonathan, and your favourite show, Party of Five,
that
teen drama. And also your other favourite, the Scream franchise. But, of course, I love her in The Lincoln Lawyer as Mickey's ex-wife.
Oh, you see, I might have almost got that.
She's great in that. Anyway, not that Neave. Neave Campbell.
Wait, but mind you, that would have been impressive.
Yeah. I mean, what she was doing.
She's a real slashy.
God, go on, other Neave, write a book. We'll review it, we promise.
So start her. This is Neave Campbell, a Dublin writer and the author of This Happy back in 2020, and We Were Young in 2022. Now, she's won the Sunday Times Audible Short Story Award And the Rooney Prize for Irish Literature. I like the idea of an Audible short story award.
Why?
The clunk they make when you throw them on the table.
Okay, you're going, you're entering next year.
It's a very good dad joke.
Oh my God, straight in the
A speciality cut down by Zan Rowe. Madeline, how does this new novel, Make Strange, how does that begin?
Well, so Make Strange begins with, I think, a brilliant first hook, which is we begin with a couple, Lena and Oren, and they live in Dublin now, and they have a small child, Sunny, who is three. And Sunny keeps saying to her mother and to others at daycare around, "Mama, do you remember when I died?" And Sunny thinks that she has lived another life with another family and that she died near a side of a road that had water near it, and she just keeps bringing it up. And so we begin the novel with Lena in a state of, you know, maternal disarray because she's trying to work out what's happening with her child, if her child is in some kind of form of psychosis or if she is just really imaginative. And she finds she's going around to doctors trying to work out what's happening, and everyone's dismissing her, you know, kind of female paranoia. And there's a lot about motherhood in this novel. So that's the original hook. But then it becomes something a lot larger as Campbell is really thinking about early motherhood as something that totally waves over your brain in a way that your mind becomes just something different than it was before. And every waking thought this woman has is about her child and how she is going to provide a life for her child. And then it's set in the context of Ireland and Dublin in particular going through, you know, the post-bubble bursting in the economy. There's no housing, jobs are hard to come by. And, you know, how does one make a life? That's really the question.
Yes. Well, you described that beautifully. It's interior, it's people in their 30s trying to figure out, you know, who they are, how do they get to this point where the rest of their life is visible from here. But the motherhood, the parenthood part of it is very strong. But let's just go back to that first page because it's quite beautifully constructed.
Yeah, and the sentences are gorgeous.
Yeah, it's just, so they're sort of lazing around. It's a Sunday in October, which means, you know, summer's passed, the days are getting shorter in Ireland. And Sunny's been sick all day and she's sort of flopping around. And then she goes to have a sleep and they just sort of forget about her, I think. And they took advantage of the relative peace to read newspapers and make adult conversation. But around 7 o'clock, when darkness had come and the ambient mundanity of Monday loomed, they became afraid. The cough she'd had for days seemed suddenly wetter and worse. A&E, said Lena. Do you think it's that bad? Probably not. But the out-of-hours clinic is chaos. Chaos, agreed Oren, and brought the car around. I mean, it's sort of great because who as a parent hasn't been there when there's that creeping emergency where you think, my God, you know,
yeah.
A few hours ago this was just a cough and now we could be on the edge of...
But also on a Sunday, there goes the week.
Yeah, that's right.
The mundanity of Monday is a great,
isn't it?
Great combination of words.
Yeah, and there are so many phrases like that in this book. Oren's mother. Oren comes from a family that's wealthy in Ireland. They're landed. They live in a farmhouse on a lot of land that no longer has a farm on it, you know. So they've been disconnected from the history of what that place was. They don't need to plough potatoes or whatever anymore. They can just live in the house and presumably have other properties around that they can rent out to people who do have to farm. But she's in her later years, Sonia, and she's been renovating the farmhouse in what Neve Campbell describes as a menopausal opulence of neutrals and soft furnishings, you know, like... It's this great sort of creeping vibe that comes from Sonia that infects the whole family, I think. She's just clearly the matriarch, and it's just so well described in little phrases like that.
And what happens to little Sunny?
Happens to little Sunny? Isn't that the question? The question on everyone's lips.
Well, that's exactly right. And the one that, as a reader, I kept coming back to as we traversed a lot of other material, but the creeping Sunny story does continue as this It's like a sort of rising horror filmed soundtrack.
That's right. Underneath. Yeah, because it really is, you know, it's contemporary realism. It's not actually a thriller. And yet the way that it's written is kind of like a ghost story with this creeping sense of unease. And we kind of sometimes forget about Sonny's like strange apparitions of death for a while. And then we're very much brought back into them. And they modulate the novel. They act as the tension, but they aren't actually the majority of the plot.
Yeah.
That's clever though, technically, isn't it? To sort of create that suspense through omission.
Yeah, exactly.
And there's some people who totally believe that Sonny is seeing things or knows things. In fact, Sonia is one of them. And she says, I've known a lot of magical children.
I know, I was going to say that the phrase magical children or magic children, as she says, is such a beautiful one. And it's quite Celtic as well, like the idea of fairies and child swapping and kind of kids being more knowledgeable about the spiritual world than adults are. They have some kind of access to another realm that
goes away.
Lots
of children talk to ghosts, she says.
Yeah, exactly. Although, you know, my brother had imaginary friends for years.
Yeah.
And so Sunny is kind of like, in a way, you know, she's young, she's three, but she is able to access a connection to land and to spirituality that her parents have lost as they are fighting to survive in precarious economic conditions. Because she did have... For years ago, she was a musician, and there's a whole backstory there about how she was working with this terrible music dude who screwed her over. And then she starts working in a Georgian house museum, I think doing some kind of, she doesn't really explicitly say, but basically when she has Sonny, she has to give that up because childcare is so expensive and it costs more for her to go to work and then to pay for childcare, then it's actually more cost effective if she quits her job and just
relies on Oren's income.
Relies on Oren's income, who, and he like vaguely works in tech. And so it's really, you know, her identity has now become totally like subsumed in her maternal role as well. So it's quite crippling. It's quite claustrophobic.
Yeah, there's no way out for her because she has this creative background and she was really on the cusp of some kind of success as a musician.
Yeah, like a mini celebrity, you know. Yeah. You know, people who were like famous in 2008 in one place, you know, like she was famous in Dublin in maybe the early 2000s and people sometimes recognised her on the street.
Yes, and Oren was instantly attracted to her.
He loved that part of her.
Yeah, because having a relationship with her or at least being seen with her proved to other people that he was better than they'd thought he was.
Exactly, yeah, made him cool. But then, you know, because of the financial crisis, then they're like, perhaps we have to move back to Clare, to where we're from. And it's kind of embarrassing and they're kind of defensive about it, as I think a lot of people are who have to leave big cities and go home shamefacedly. That's kind of the energy that they're bringing to this move.
But also it's possible that Oren is slightly boring and going back to live with...
I would say it's more than possible.
And the whole time is she stuck with this ghost child? Is that part of the horror as well, that she's now a stay-at-home mum with a ghost child that may have been killed in a horrible way?
I think that's part of it, Sam.
Ghost child and boring part.
Yeah, and actually thinking this...
And shattered dreams of fame.
That's right. And Kean, the you described him as terrible.
Yeah, the old musical partner.
You know, he was a bad boy
and he was
awful to her, but my God, they're attractive, those guys, when you're in your late teens and 20s. And now she's regretting going out with this boring tech guy.
Yeah, she's like, I would have popped off on Tumblr, you know, back in the day. And now I'm with this dude, which sucks, and his family's pretty annoying.
But anyway, back to what happens with Sonny. Now, there's two things that you kind of need to know. And one is that while, you know, the parents are taking her to MRI, well, really it's the mother who's taking her to all these MRI appointments and medical appointments and trying to ascertain.
The dad has to be at very important tech conferences.
Yeah, that's right. Yeah. And the staff are sort of asking her, oh, is this your first child? And she sees one write down, mother concern in the notes with the reason for presentation. So there's this suggestion that she is actually imagining this illness in Sonny. But the other part of it comes from the meaning of her name, which is actually Suneva. Suneva is an ancient sort of Irish name from the legend of the heir of an Irish kingdom. And she was forced to flee Ireland for Norway because of invasions, etc. I'm unclear on this part. And she was martyred. Her body, apparently, when it was discovered, because there was this beautiful, sweet smell and someone found her body incorrupt.
Okay.
Which, of course, in sanctification terms means, you know, she was perfectly intact and like she had just closed her eyes. Mm. And so, you know, there's a very old story behind the name of the child.
Mm. So she is the devil.
Or someone who...
or perhaps, you know, has been here before.
Who knows? The ghost in question.
Exactly.
There is a very big reveal right at the end. We do need
There's
a good twist, but it kind of comes right at the end. So we're not going to do that to poor Niamh.
Yeah.
We're not going to ruin it.
Characterise the novel for us. Is it?
Because it sounds like a horror. It
sounds thrillerish and yet not.
But also a comment on childcare and all kinds of things. Like there's... And
the IT industry.
And Ireland's economy. Like what kind of book is this?
Well, I'll pick up on the Ireland's economy part. Mm. The apartment that the parents are in Dublin is a rent-to-buy place. They're not really owning it, but they're paying a lot to be there. A lot of the description is beautiful about the way old Dublin and the surrounding towns are being basically overtaken by this crawling development. Mm. Houses are being built that people can't even afford to live in, but on it goes, on it goes. And there's a line in one of the parts saying difference between the Spanish and the Irish, that when the Spanish walked away from Catholicism in the contemporary times, they did it because they wanted sex.
Mm-hmm.
And when the Irish did it in the contemporary times, it was because they wanted money.
Money, exactly. Niamh has said previously, she's explained it as, you know, for so long, the common enemy of the Irish people was the church. And then post-crash, the common enemy becomes banks. We can see that in so much contemporary realist Irish fiction. It's everywhere. And it's very much in this book. And I feel like this book is, it's very much a reflection of Campbell's concerns throughout her work. Her first book, This Happy, is a beautiful book about a young woman. It starts when she's about 13. She's about to marry someone. And then she looks back on her life and remembers an affair she once had with an old professor. So it's kind of about gender relations and not so much about the economy, although I suppose it is about the economy of desire. Her second book is really about this bisexual flaneur who is in his 40s and just kind of walks around Dublin treating people poorly. And
that sounds a great character.
I actually loved it. I mean, I don't know if I'm expressing this, but I love her writing so much that when I was choosing my English publisher first time around for the first book, I actually chose the person that I did because they were the publisher for Niamh Campbell for This Happy. But what the themes in this novel are showing is there's a kind of a narrative force towards dealing now with the problems that someone in their 30s would have in Ireland, which really is money. Mm. And money runs through this like kind of melancholic, you know, rivers of gold.
Mm.
Just one more thing before we go on is I think that the epigraph of books always speak a lot to the themes that their authors are trying to get to. And the epigraph for this book is from the work of Lauren Boulant, who's one of my favourite cultural theorists. And it's, I'll read it here. Everyone knows what the female complaint is. Women live for love, and love is the gift that keeps on taking. So I think if you want to know the tone of the book, that actually pretty much sums it up.
That's nice.
Yeah.
That's a feel-good novel then, is what you're saying.
Oh, gosh, so happy. Yeah, it's going to be a Reader's Book Club pick. Yeah.
And that is Make Strange by the Irish Niamh Campbell. Well, Jonathan, and I think our guests have been rather swell today. Shall we find out what they have also been reading?
I think it behooves us, Cassie.
Who shall we ask first, Jonathan?
Zan.
I've been reading lots, as I like to do. That's why I'm here. But I recently read a book by James Rebanks, who many people would know as the author of The Shepherd's Life, where he basically talked about his life as a shepherd.
Hmm.
And it was an unassuming book that did huge numbers, huge sales in the UK, where he's from. He's a journalist. He's been writing for many, many years, but he's also a farmer. His most recent book is called A Place of Tides. It is a beautiful book where he goes to a very far northern island off the coast of Norway, and I'm talking like has to take him about 2 or 3 days to get there, lots of boats, very remote, to do a story on a woman who goes out each season, each winter, to protect the eider down ducks. Now, eider down is the light incredibly expensive feather that if you're lucky you get in nice coats.
You have to pluck it out of their nests, don't you?
You have to pluck it out of their nests. Mm. And it is a very old tradition in these islands in Norway. That is, again, this environmental response of overfishing, of the changing of the climate, is meaning that less and less ducks are coming to shore, coming and nesting, and then leaving the eider down behind. So he basically goes out and does this story and meets this woman and is so captivated by her. This very old woman has been doing it her whole life, that he decides to go back and spend a season with her. And it's one of the most beautiful meditative books about not just committing your life to a very old craft that is on its way out, but about climate change, about his feeling. It's very personal as well, as a farmer and journalist who becomes an author and then all of a sudden is whizzing around the world, constantly doing book tours.
But then stops for a year. Wow.
And sits in this space, and through that, as he's kind of going there at a point of exhaustion, realises, is sort of brought back to the beginning of what actually matters. She's an amazing character. It's a really slow and beautiful book, but I just found it so mesmerising and nothing that I'd ever known about before, which is one of the great things about books, right? It takes you into a world that you never knew existed. This is one of those books, and he's just such a beautiful writer. So highly recommend that. Even if you've never read A Shepherd's Life, he's a beautiful writer because he's a journalist. He knows how to bring you in, no matter who you are and where you come from. He really draws you into this story, and it's just glorious.
Okay, that's James Rebank's The Place of Tides. What about you, Madeline Gray?
I've got two. The first one is Returns and Exchanges by an American author, Kayla Ray Whittaker.
Great title.
It's such a good title. Her debut was called The Animators and it came out in 2018, so it's taken her a fair while to come out with a second book, and I've been looking forward to it for years. This one, it is set in Kentucky in the 1980s and it's a family saga, and the family owns and runs a chain of like discount retail stores. And it really just kind of follows the relations between the family over 10 years, looking at, you know, sexuality, gender, shame, but also just particular intensity of being really tight with your family and also working with them. And it looks at the rise of Walmart-esque stores that kind of buy out, that get rid of all of their family-owned stores. But it's just beautifully written. I really loved it.
I love the idea of going to Kentucky in the 1980s. That's great.
Yeah. She always writes about kind of the parts of America you don't get to see that much. And then the second book is so much fun. It's called Fruit Fly by Josh Silver. It's kind of like, I'm going to say this and it's going to sound so wrong, but just, it's like a queer Yellowface. And I'll explain, in the sense that the book Yellowface is about a white woman kind of appropriating Chinese culture and pretending to be Asian to sell her book because she thinks that, you know, minorities are in. And in this book,
such a great premise.
It's such a good premise. And in this book, Josh clearly has read Yellowface, but he's having fun with it. It's a writer, Mallory, who had a hit like 10 years ago. She hasn't been able to write anything since. She's like middle class and straight. Then she kind of gets this idea in her head. She's like, wait, the books that are really selling are like gay, sad books. And so it's obviously like a dig to like Shuggie Bane or like A Little Life.
And A Little Life, don't get me started.
Yeah, so she finds this gay drug addict and essentially just mines his life story for this novel. And it's just, it's so terrible and wonderful. It's like a real page turner and such a biting satire of the literary world today.
Utterly brilliant.
Sign me up.
Yep.
I've just added it to my library.
Zero, put that on. Just getting that book.
Great cover too. Very cool cover.
Yeah. Oh, there's always so much to read. Hey, look, Zan, Madeline, thank you so much for reading with us today. It's been great to catch up with you.
Thanks, Cassie.
Well, Jonathan Green, what a delight it has been reading with you once again.
It's been fun to drop in. It really has.
I hope you've enjoyed the selection that we found for you.
Well, and I've got suggestions to take with me, so I'm very happy.
Well, we'll look out for you on every bite. Lovely to see you. Next time on The Bookshelf, we're looking at some of our biggest books from recent times, the ones definitely worth tracking down. But for now, I'm Cassie McCullough. I will see you next week.